When Mr. Jeffrey asked me if I would give a lecture on William Carey, I at first didn't want to, because the only thing I knew of William Carey was that he had something to do with Leicester, that he was a missionary to India, and that he coined the expression that has become well known, expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. And I knew that I'd got a lot of reading and studying to do if I was going to do this. And even when I did consent and then get into reading about Carey, I still was beginning to think, well, I think I'll ring him up and see if he can get somebody else or get some other subject, because I didn't get grip to begin with. But I must confess that as I've gone on with studying the life of William Carey, I've been exceedingly blessed and encouraged and had my own vision enlarged. Now, I've got one volume before me tonight, which is S. Pierce Carey, on William Carey, and there are other volumes about and available, and there's a new one that's recently come out, which I hadn't had time to get hold of or read, because I didn't know about it until just a couple of weeks ago. But someone else has been having a go at trying to plumb the depth of this man who had got such a breadth and such a capacity that it's almost impossible to do justice to him. And some lady has become very interested in the philosophy that lay behind William Carey. And indeed, some of his ways were so advanced, I doubt whether they'd be accepted today in many circles, and certainly not in the days when he was putting them into operation towards the end of his life. And this is why he acted very independently and didn't even consult the Home Committee. He got on with the job because he thought, well, what can they do way back in London? And they haven't been here, and I've been here for these 20, 30 odd years. And so he got on with the work that was quite advanced, as you'll see at the end of the paper tonight. He was indeed a giant of a man, though little in stature. And many a little man of stature has been a big man in spirit and in mind and in heart, and William Carey was one such man. John Newton was very sceptical to begin with of him, but John Newton wrote this about him later on. William Carey is more than a bishop or an archbishop. He is an apostle. Now today we have great arguments as to whether people are apostles or not, but a man also has said this, that the spirit of the apostle is missionary. And every true pioneer missionary has the apostolic spirit. And that is what John Newton meant here when he said he's more than a bishop or an archbishop. He was, or is, of course, in John Newton's day, he is an apostle. History is rich with facts of what God has done with men who have worked together with him. Men who have been prepared and men who have been single-eyed in the work of God. And William Carey was one such man. Ancestry, I believe, is important. It's at a discount today, but you can look back on breeding and you can see how that ancestry and breeding have produced minds and intellects and characters. And William Carey's ancestry was nothing particularly outstanding in terms of being known, and none of them, of course, were known outside of their own villages. But they did rise to be the chief people of their villages, in that they were teachers, schoolmasters, and they would be parish clerks and so on. So they were people of some ability within their own sphere. But they were people of great spirit. Carey himself was born in Northamptonshire, in Paula's Pury, on the 17th of August, 1761. To try to put that into perspective, John Wesley at that time was 58 years of age. And so you can imagine the things that have been going on in the country. He was born to Edmund and Elizabeth, his parents. They lived with Edmund's mother, had recently been widowed, and she lived with them when William was born and came onto the scene of this life. They were not evangelicals. They were very ardent Anglicans, and they despised the dissenters. And William Carey carried that spirit with him right through to his conversion, as we shall see in a little while. The times in which he was born were exciting times. Everything seemed to be happening. The country seemed to be coming alive. The French Revolution had taken place. There was a British Revolution going on, not as the French Revolution, but certainly a revolution in terms of industry and philanthropy. The world, Britain was becoming the world's factory and market, and we have this comment made about it. A fresh vision was dawning of the possibilities of man. Compassion was waking for the imprisoned and the insane. Westminster was protecting India from British greed. Clergy were called to devout social service by the life of William Law. Wesley was publishing the vitalizing evangel. Redeemed ones were quickened to poetry and praise. Rigid Calvinisms were yielding. Churches, weary of inefficient isolation, were beginning to combine. Collective prayer was becoming a contagion. Scientific discoveries were pregnant with results. Industrial, commercial, and social change was at the doors. Britain's business world was being reasoned into an opening of closed areas. The unevangelized peoples were burdening at least a few British consciences and constraining them towards paths of missionary toil. You can imagine a young man growing in that atmosphere. And he was very taken with the French Revolution. And he was indeed himself politically a Republican right through life. And he was almost dreaming of a kind of French Revolution taking place in this country. His childhood, of course, was a very rural one, born in this little village and in the centre of England, and he was absorbed in nature study. I have to mention this because it forms a very great part of his life. His sister wrote this of him at this period: of birds and all manner of insects he had numbers. When he was from home, the birds were committed to my care. Being more than 5 years younger, I was indulged by him in all his enjoyments. Though I often killed them with kindness, yet when he saw my grief over his dead pets, he always relented and gave me the pleasure of serving them again, and often took me over the dirtiest roads to get at a plant or an insect. He never walked out, when quite a boy, without making observations on the hedges as he passed. And when he took up a plant of any kind, he always studied it with care. That was Carey's early interests, and a little later on he himself had this to say. His sister said, whatever he began, he finished. Difficulties never discouraged him. As he grew, his passion for knowledge increased. And then he went on to say, his brother goes on to say, from a boy he was studious, deeply and fully bent on learning all he could, and determined never to give up a particle of anything on which his mind was set, till he had arrived at a clear knowledge and sense of his subject. He was neither diverted by allurements nor driven from its research by ridicule or threats. He himself gave himself to study nature at that time in all its fullness. That's a very important thing which you'll see later on. In 1772, at the age of 11, he was apprenticed to Clark Nichols. At the age of 11, we tend to shelter our kids, don't we, at that age, and we think, well, at 13 they still need a little bit. But of course, by then he'd been working quite some time and learning to stand on his own initiative. Here he was apprenticed to a man by the name of Nicholas Clark, who was a shoemaker, and he was apprenticed, of course, for 7 years. Nicholas Clark was a strict churchman, but of course he was not a born-again man. He was a strict churchman, but he had a bad temper and a bad tongue. His Saturdays were given over to drinking, and he worked his apprentices very hard. A second apprentice was set on by the name of John Waugh, of nonconformist Christian stock. And John Waugh and Carey often argued together over nonconformity and the church. Carey says this: "I have moreover pride sufficient for 1,000 times my knowledge, so I always scorned to have the worst in discussion, and the last word was assuredly mine. I always made up in positive assertion that was lacking in my reasoning, and generally came off with triumph. But I was often afterwards convinced that, though I had the last word, my fellow apprentice had the better of the argument. And I felt a growing uneasiness, and strings of conscience gradually, stings of conscience gradually increasing, but had no idea that nothing but a complete change of heart could do me any good." He began learning. He started to borrow books and to use the books of his employer. And conviction started to come over him. He was given for a Christmas present on one occasion a counterfeit shilling. And he decided on temptation that he was going to use this shilling. And he put it in between some change that belonged to his master, and was able to pass the shilling and to keep a good shilling in return for it. But that was a means of really pricking his conscience, and in turn bringing him to a deeper relationship with his fellow apprentice, because he recognized that in John Waugh there was something deep and something very wonderful. He began at this time also to learn Greek from a man who was a failed doctor, and he got hold of this fellow, and he used to pursue him and learn Greek. He would write down from some of his master's books, he would write down the characters, and then when he got to go to this doctor, this man who failed in his medical profession, when he got to go to this man with shoes or pass his door or whatever, he would call him and say, "Now what does this mean?" And he would so build up his knowledge of Greek in that way. Don't forget, he started when he was 11, so between 11 and 7 years later, and 18, he was learning. This was the character of the man coming out. The first time he ever attended a chapel, and he condescended to attend a chapel, was on a day which was called for national prayer and fasting. Things were going badly in the country with the threat arising from the French Revolution and so on, and so there was this national day of prayer and fasting, and he attended the chapel with his colleague. There was an untrained lay preacher. It's a little bit like Spurgeon when he turned into the primitive Methodist chapel, and there the man could hardly put two sentences together, but that man was used to the conversion of Spurgeon. Here he turned in, he went to this nonconformist chapel, and there was an untrained lay preacher, and his message was, "Let us go forth therefore unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach." He spoke of this and said, "It pierced my heart." But the only thing that came out of that at that time was this: he determined from then on not to be a churchman, but to be a nonconformist. And he cannot actually point to the date when he was converted. As far as I've been able to find anyway, Carey didn't know just when he was converted, but certainly stirrings were going on. Conviction over using this bad shilling, the conviction from this sermon that was preached here, his determination to be a nonconformist. During this spiritual pilgrimage, and don't forget, still during this apprenticeship period, he came under the influence of some mystical heretics, and it took his apprentice friend again to help him through that difficult period. And then he came under the influence of a man by the name of Thomas Scott. Now that name might mean something to you when you know that you can get Scott's commentary, and this was the same man. And he came in touch with this man Thomas Scott, who was able indeed to help him and put him on the right way. And Carey says this: "If there be anything of the work of God in my soul, I owe much of it to Mr. Scott's preaching when I first set out in the ways of the Lord." This same Thomas Scott, interestingly enough, later on in life was used for the conversion of John Henry Newman, who later, of course, you know, through his spiritual wanderings, became the first Anglican clergyman to go over to the Church of Rome and to become a cardinal. But John Henry Newman seems to have professed a conversion under the same preacher Thomas Scott. Clary was baptized in 1783 by John Ryland, and we have at least one hymn in our hymn book by John Ryland, who was a very well-known figure in missionary circles, and of course was to become even more well-known through Carey, whom he was baptizing at this particular time. Ryland comments on this occasion about this baptism. On October the 5th, 1783, I baptized in the Neen, just beyond Doddridge's meeting house, a poor journeyman shoemaker, little thinking that before 9 years elapsed, he would prove the first instrument of forming a society for sending missionaries from England to the heathen world, and much less that later he would become professor of languages in an oriental college, and the translator of the scriptures into 11 different languages. You notice these figures and these facts, because they are of staggering, and they're of vital importance to us in the life of this little shoemaker. I haven't got it down in my notes, but whilst we think about the fact that he was shoemaker, he was on one occasion sitting at some banquet with some important people in India, and there was some army officer at the side of him who was wanting to belittle this missionary at his side, and he said, aren't you the shoemaker from Serampore? He said, no sir, just a repairer. That was William Carey. By this time he was 23. You can obviously say that I'm missing out great pieces of good and delicious information which you need to look at. By this time he was 23. He was married, they'd had their first child who had died, he had helped found a new meeting at Hackleton, and it's interesting to notice that although he was a Baptist missionary, and indeed became a strict Baptist in India itself, at this time of founding this meeting in Hackleton, that he didn't impose any doctrine on baptism. Everyone was free to believe what they wanted to believe about baptism. He later on came back to that position, which is a very important thing to remember. Now, as we know, he went off to India, but that was some 10 years after this matter of baptism. And I want to just dwell for a few minutes before we get onto the Indian trail. I want us to have a look at a couple of the two pastorates he held in the meantime, in these 10 years after his baptism and before going off to India. First of all, in the village of Moulton, he was a pastor there from 1785 to 89, just 4 years. He lived on 4 shillings a week. That was less than a farm labourer of the day. He rebuilt the chapel. There were so many conversions they had to have an enlargement of the chapel. This is all within 4 years, mind you. He here persisted to learn Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, adding also Italian and French within 4 years, whilst running a pastorate, whilst enlarging the building and looking after the new converts, and at the same time still carrying on his trade in order to make ends meet. Now, what a man. You already begin to say something of the enormity of this man's character and ability. In this pursuit, his employer was very kind to him, and this is what happened under the providence of God. And I like these little things along the way, because it shows how people were beginning to take notice of Carey. So upon a day when Carey brought to Lower Street again his fortnight's labour, Gotch, that's the man who was paying him for all his work, said, "Let me see, Mr. Carey, how much do you earn a week for your shoemaking?" "About 9 or 10 shillings, sir." Then said Gotch, with twinkling eyes, "Well now, I've a secret for you. I don't mean you to spoil any more of my leather. But get on as fast as you can with your Latin and Hebrew and Greek, and I'll allow you from my private purse weekly 10 shillings. Well, there was a man with a bit of insight who was going to help this servant of God It's good, isn't it, to have an eye like that, instead of being absorbed with everything round about us, to have an eye at what God is doing. And maybe we can encourage somebody. Maybe you can't see what they're going to do in the future, but to encourage somebody along the way like that. How we ought to be much more observant and be part of God's providences. Carey became a member of the minister's fraternal in Northampton. They had fraternals in those days, and we still have them today, and he became a member of that fraternal, and it had some well-known names in it, including, of course, the man we've already mentioned, Ryland. And Ryland insisted that Carey should offer a theme for discussion. This is what we do at Loughborough, and we get insisted upon as well. So Carey proposed this for a theme for discussion, and this was it: whether the command given to the apostles to teach all nations was not binding on all ministers to the end of the world. Now there's a great topic for you. Here, the famous objection came from what was described as a vehement, gruff Calvinist. And some of you will know the objection I'm referring to. This has been disputed, but apparently I think the evidence comes down on its validity, upon its truth, and it's this: young man, sit down, you're an enthusiast. When God pleases to convert the heathen, he'll do it without consulting you or me. Besides, there must first be a Pentecostal gift of tongues. That's before the charismatic started. Here was a gruff old Calvinist, and he says there must first be a Pentecostal gift of tongues. But Carey was undaunted by this rebuff, and he continued extensive study of the world. He got a map which he had constructed himself, which he had built up himself, and he had also made a globe out of leather. And he got every little island and everything that you could find, that he could find about the world, he got it all there on this map and on this globe. There's an illuminating incident, if I can just light upon it. Yes, there was someone asking about a particular island within a meeting of ministers, and the name of this island came up, and no one could say anything about it. Nobody had heard of it. It was one of the East Indian Isles, as they would have been called then. And this is the comment about it: neither Hall, that was Robert Hall, of course, well-known preacher, we still see his sermons for sale now in second-hand bookshops, Robert Hall, Rowland, Sutcliffe, nor Fuller could supply the needed information. Presently, from a back corner, with much reticence, Carey reported its location, its length, its breadth, its nature, and the number and religious character of its people, to the amazement of the rest, who as good as said, how do you know? There it is, that he got it all. But that wouldn't be one island. He'd be able to tell you about all the islands and all the countries. And he just longed to be a missionary to these islands and to take out the news of God's great redeeming love. He was accused of neglecting his business. Neglect my business, Carey. My business, sir, is to extend the kingdom of Christ. I only make and mend shoes to help pay expenses. And that is where the fire burnt in his soul. I only make and mend shoes to pay expenses. That was a principle all through his life, even when he got to India. And that was the first pastorate then. And all this was going on in that time. And then he moved to Leicester. And he moved to Leicester in 1789, and he was there till 1793, again 4 years. The church he went to was a scandal. There was immorality, there was heresy, and they had 3 pastors in 3 years. Now, we think the churches are in a bad way today. That was the Baptist church in Leicester. And so he came into that awful situation. And after his first year, Fuller, Andrew Fuller, wrote this about Carey and the church in Leicester. He was distressed beyond measure at the trials of his situation. And the report of the church to Olney, the annual report sent to the Olney meeting, was, "We have the word preached among us in its purity." This is the church now, this bad church responding. "And we hope that it is pleasant to the souls of many of us. But far from enjoying harmony and peace, we are divided 3 against 2 and 2 against 3. Nor can we boast that meetings of prayer are well attended, though the monthly prayer meetings for the spread of the gospel are better attended than the weekly. The number of our members is 2 less than a year ago. The number of our members is 2 less than a year ago. Here's the future missionary, here's the great Carey in Leicester after his first year. That's the report on the state of the church. You can imagine the hard time he was having there. However, he continued in his trade and he studied. And this was the plan of his studies. On Monday, the classics. On Tuesday, science, history, composition. Wednesday to Saturday, Hebrew, Greek, sermons. In the meantime, he evangelized the villages of Thurmaston, Syston, Sarsby, Blaby and Desford. He became secretary of Leicester's Nonconformist Committee, which involved him in a lot of work regarding appeals of various acts and laws, in the improvement of the brutally treated prisoners, and the improvement of cruelty to the insane, or mentally ill, as we would call them now. And in addition to that, he threw in his lot with the abolition of the slave trade. That's in addition to looking after his pastorate, which eventually was settled and began to grow, and the church was established and flourished before he left in 4 years' time. Now, in addition to that, he joined the town's scientists, a place apparently which was full of telescopes and electrical equipments. And Carey was the man who set up the first lightning conductor in Leicester, much to the fear of the populace at that time, which was 13,000. The population of Leicester, 13,000. As I've already said, he was a Republican and sympathized with the French Revolution, and he was a man who was full of faith and who continued in his work in the pastorate. So you've got all that, the languages and these sidelines of interest in science at the same time. What a shoemaker, what a cobbler. He continued to yearn for the world's millions. This is on top of the things that I've already read to you. He published a pamphlet entitled The Inquiry, and this called on his brethren, that was Ryland, Fuller, Sutcliffe, Pierce and others, to become ambassadors for Christ and attempt an overseas mission. That was his great concern. He was going to establish a mission. And this was the result of 8 years praying and thinking. I think if I got half of what he got to do, I wouldn't have had time to pray and think. But there he was, praying, thinking, learning, working, evangelizing, pastoring, writing, and in his spare time was interested in science. I mean, who could get it in? I don't know. But we do have a quote of interest here, which I must bring to you, concerning this period. And this is from the pamphlet which he put out. You can see something of his heart here concerning missions. "Was not Christ's charge to evangelize the nations addressed to the apostles and not meant for us? Why then do we baptize? If baptism concerns us, well, missions must no less. The two were bidden in one breath, were part and parcel of each other. Besides, we claim our share in his promise. Lo, I am with you. We have no right to the promise unless we observe the command. The one conditions the other. To neglect his commission is to forfeit his benefits. But how do we know that this command is still valid? Not even divine injunctions abide forever. They have their periods and pass, like the Levitical law. Nay, divine injunctions abide till they have fulfilled their function. Who can think this commission exhausted, with the vast majority of mankind not yet acquainted with Christ? But were there not God set limits to the execution of the commission, even in apostolic days? Was not Paul forbidden to go to pagan Bithynia? Yes, because the divine purpose needed him then more elsewhere. But he was ceaselessly missionary, as we must ever be. We miss out a lot of it, but these are important arguments. But must not a second miraculous Pentecost precede and permit successful world missions? In other words, shouldn't we wait for a Pentecost? Shouldn't we wait for what we're praying for now, and that's revival? That seems to be our argument now, doesn't it, with some brethren? And this seemed to be the argument then. Must we not wait for a second miraculous Pentecost? Don't forget, here's the Calvinist talking. These are the Calvinists of that century, talking about a second Pentecost. You don't mention it today. This logic comes too late, he says. Its theory collides with fact. Wherever the Christ has been lovingly offered to men, some and often many have accepted the gift with joy. God's power has been proven. If God purposes to save the heathen, he will not take steps to effect it. God's one deliberate method is to work through consecrated men. But we have not task enough to engage us, but have we not task enough to engage us with the heathen at home? Forsooth, there are thousands of our fellow countrymen living as far from God as possible. Then he goes on that we should pity no less the heathen who are abroad. I haven't got time to go on any more with that, but there's tremendous arguments he brings out here in this inquiry which he published about our going abroad. He talks about prayer. He says, when traders form a company and win a charter, they go to the limit of their secured concessions and prerogatives, choosing stocks, ships, known routes, everything in accordance with their purpose. They strain every nerve, run every risk, count every informant, dare every danger, watch every vessel, await every homecoming, mourn every delay, nor ever rest till the rich returns are safe in port. We Christians must be in equal earnest for the business of our Lord. I mean, what stirring arguments are these? Then we must pray as well as pray, as well as pray and plan. Let the rich embark a generous portion of their God-entrusted wealth. It will yield them liberal returns. Let those of more moderate income devote a proportion, say a tenth of their annual increase, to God, after the pattern of the patriarchs, the precepts of Moses and the practices of many Puritans, and so on. He goes on, then we have only to keep the end in view and have our hearts thoroughly engaged in its pursuit, and means will not be difficult. Get the thing in your sight and the means will not be difficult. He certainly was a go-getter, as we say. He preached what was known as a deathless sermon. And it's based upon the passage we had from Isaiah. And this sermon was something he prayed over very earnestly. And it's from there that we get that great saying that has come to us and we can often repeat, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. But in that sermon he emphasizes the order in which they come. He didn't say attempt great things for God first. He says you expect first. We must expect God, and when we're expecting, then we can attempt, because our attemptings then will equal our expectings. And so expect great things and attempt great things for God. Unfortunately, this sermon fell on deaf ears, and on that occasion nothing stirred. He was deeply disappointed with the response. However, some did take up the suggestion a little later on, and in Kettering on the 2nd of October 1792, where in the very town where Doddridge in 1741 had endeavoured to establish a mission society, but it was still born, it didn't come to anything. Here, Carey, with these few people, get together in what we know as the lean-to parlour at the back of the house. 12 ministers packed into this little room, and there was born World Missions, as we have them today. They made a resolution. Let me read you the resolution. Humbly desirous of making an effort for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen, according to the recommendations of Carey's inquiry, we unanimously resolve to act in society together for this purpose, and as in the divided state of Christendom, each denomination, by exerting itself separately, seems likeliest to accomplish the greatest end, we name this the particular Baptist Society for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen. They put their money where their mouths were, and they collected between them, poor as they were, £13, 2 shillings and 6 pence. And that's how he all started. He became their missionary elect. He announced the decision that he was going to India after the agreement with the brethren to the Harvey Lane meeting, his church in Leicester, and he was coming to the end of that 4 years. And we read this. On the Sunday, he told Harvey Lane, "Never did I see such sorrow manifested as rained through our place of worship," though he had not forgotten the mourning of Morton. And then a little later on, we find a letter written by a man from Leicester describing the scene of the church in Harvey Lane. I'm sorry, I'm just overstepping myself in saying that. Here it is. No, I haven't got that letter. Can't just drop on it. But anyway, I can tell you, a man was there who was from Yorkshire, I think, and he wrote about this scene, and he says that the whole church was moved to tears at the news that their minister was to leave them and to go abroad. At first, Mrs. Carey wasn't going with them. She and the children would stay and they would follow later on. Before long, they did agree that the eldest son should accompany the father for some encouragement to him, and that he would have someone with him. Oh yes, and I've got the reference now to this letter. Let me read it to you. This is a man talking then now about the reaction of Wesley. I asked him about the reaction of Carey. I asked him if he felt his mind comfortable in his proceedings. He answered, "Yes, I do." He squeezed my hand to his breast and he said, "Yes, I do. My family and friends are dear to me. I feel much on account of leaving them, but I am clear that I am called to go. I am perfectly sure that it is the will of heaven that I must go. Therefore, I am happy in obeying that call." And so he set himself, of course, to go and to make all the arrangements for that. Fuller makes a description of the day in these words. "Our undertaking to India..." I'm sorry. What I'm doing is just overrunning myself a little bit, and I should stick to my notes a little bit more. Yes, I've got it here. Fuller makes this comment about the farewell meeting. "I need not say it was a solemn and affectionate meeting. Thousands of tears of joy have been shed. We love Christ better. We love one another better. A new bond of union subsists between the church and ministers. How many names will now be embalmed in our remembrance forever? When we review the shortness of the time and the magnitude of the object, we are like them that dream. It seems too great to be true. We fasted, prayed, and trembled when we set out. We felt we were launching a vessel that needed superior ability to steer. At length we ventured, and hitherto we have succeeded. Surely the Master hath been our pilot. Perhaps the greatest storms are yet to come. Be it so. Our eyes shall be up unto him. When Christ was on board, the vessel could not sink, and those who doubted were reproved." And so they launched themselves off, as it were, to go into the unknown. They had a lot of problems over permits to go abroad. There was opposition from Parliament, even though Wilberforce tried to influence things for the missionaries' freedom. A ship eventually was secured, they got their permits, and they were about to take their leave, and he writes a final letter back to Dorothy, his wife. "My dear Dorothy, I've just received yours giving me an account of your safe delivery. This is a pleasant news indeed to me. Surely goodness and mercy follow me all my days. My stay here was very painful and unpleasant, but now I see the goodness of God in it. It was that I might hear the most pleasing accounts that I possibly could hear respecting earthly things. You wish to know in what state my mind is? I answer, it is much as when I left you. If I had all the world, I would freely give it all to have you and my dear children with me. But the sense of duty is so strong as to overpower all other considerations. I could not turn back without guilt on my soul. I find a longing to enjoy more of God, but now I am among the people of the world. I think I see more beauties in godliness than ever, and I hope enjoy God more in retirement than I have done for some time past. And he closes the letter this: as I shall be glad to hear of you and how you do as often as possible. We do not know when we shall go, but expect it will be in a week at furthest. Tell my dear children I love them dearly and pray for them constantly. Felix sends his love. I look upon this mercy as an answer to prayer indeed. Trust in God. Love to Kitty, brothers, sisters, etc. Be assured I love you most affectionately. Let me know my dear little child's name. Of course, she'd just given birth and he didn't know the dear little child's name. I am forever your faithful and affectionate husband, William. And then he added this: my health was never so well. I believe the sea makes Felix and me both as hungry as hunters. I eat a monstrous meat supper and drink a couple of glasses of wine after it without it hurting me at all. Farewell. There's a missionary for you. And so he's waiting then for the ship to sail. But as events turn out, the shipmaster refuses to take him. And all the plans and the letters and the final arrangements seem so utterly dashed. On the scene comes a man by the name of John Thomas, who's already been in India, knows the language, and is a professing Christian. Now, John Thomas has got certain shady areas in his character. But John Thomas comes on the scene, and he's a godsend at this particular time. And John Thomas takes the whole situation in hand, and he's like a Black and Decker drill. He can just about plough through anything. And John Thomas takes the whole thing into his hand, and within a week, he's found another ship. He's travelled up to Leicester. He's persuaded Mrs. Carey and the children to go with him. He takes them back down to the ship. He makes arrangements that he would serve his passage so that they got the money to pay for Mrs. Carey. Some of the children are going to help doing duties on the ship, and so they bargain with the master, and he gets everything settled all within 6 days. And he got to do that by stagecoach. And it was quite a remarkable time. Mrs. Carey doesn't want to go. She doesn't want to leave, you see. How could she face all this? The children and going off to this country and the sea voyage and everything else. And Thomas, he says, nobly proposed to Carey and Felix that Felix should be booked. They should book in on the ship. But Carey scouted the suggestion. Besides, he must see whether his wife would go with him. He begged Thomas come and had his experienced persuasions to his own. So they, Carey and Thomas, both set out in the evening at 8 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, the two took coach again together. The guards armed with a blunderbuss and a brace of pistols. That was the way to travel in England then. By 5 o'clock in the morning, they reached Northampton, and by breakfast time, Piddington and Mrs. Carey's home. Must she be chidden that with her not a month old baby at her breast and her three other laddies under nine, she could not at a day's notice face the forsaking of her kindred, the 5 months voyage and all the hazards and strangeness of Bengal. She could not drink the cup, so she refuses to go. But both men, they turn off in great despondency, going back down to the south again to get ship, and Thomas says to Carey, let me go and have another try with her. And Carey is distressed, and he doesn't want Thomas to go back, but eventually he agrees, and Thomas goes back. And this is what Thomas says. I don't care what you say. This is what Thomas says to Carey. I don't care what you say, I'm going back. I believe I can prevail. But Carey would not. Carey went on, Thomas went back. Re-entering the cottage, Thomas told of all the sobbing of his comrade's soul, of all the constraints upon his own. I simply had to come back, he said. I could not leave things so. For 6 years I have known the loneliness of a sundered family. Don't doom yourselves to such a woe. I did not press you before, but now I feel impelled in love to be severe. If you refuse to go now, you'll repent it as long as you live. You'll repent it as long as you'll live. Whereat she grew afraid. At last she cried, I'll go, if my sister here will go with me. How human and how right. Like Moses, no longer refusing God's commission when once he knew his brother was to share its weight. It's a glimpse into that home circle that, as she in after years told Ryland, Kitty slipped up into her bedroom to pray. When she came down, she was willing. And they set off together. And they board ship. Carey, of course, must have the last word about all this. It was his wife, after all. The ship is here, the signal made, the guns are fired, and we are going to a fine, with a fine fair wind. Farewell, my dear brothers and sisters, farewell. May the God of Jacob be ours and yours, by sea and land for time and eternity. Most affectionately, adieu. This has been a day of gladness to my soul. I was returned that I might take all my family with me. And the ship is here, the signal made, the guns are fired, and we are going to a fine, with a fine fair wind. Farewell, my dear brothers and sisters, farewell. May the God of Jacob be ours and yours, by sea and land for time and eternity. Most affectionately, adieu. This has been a day of gladness to my soul. I was returned that I might take all my family with me and enjoy all the blessings which I had surrendered to God. This Ebenezer I raise. I hope to be strengthened by its ever remembrance. And so they set sail. How are we going for time? All right? You've got to say that, haven't you? One writer, a Sir J.W. Kay, writes this: India was a close preserve in the hands of the East India Company. To go there without a license from the company was to become a poacher and to incur the risk of being sent ignominiously home. A man without a covenant was a dangerous person, doubly dangerous, such a one with a Bible. And Carey, of course, was such a man. He was going there, and as we've seen, he had great difficulties with his license to go. After 5 months' voyage, and on disembarking, that was in November 1793, he wrote to the Society, I hope you will go on and increase, and that multitudes may hear the glorious words of truth. Africa is but a little way from England. Madagascar, but a little further. South America and all the many and large islands of the Indian and Chinese seas will, I hope, not be forgotten. A large field opens on every side, and millions tormented by ignorant superstition and idolatry plead with every heart that loves God. Oh, that many labourers may be thrust into the vineyard, and the Gentiles come to the knowledge of the truth. Calcutta is the first place of abode. Thomas, who had already been there and knew the language, begins to preach, and they enter into many of the problems that they were to face. There were financial problems, sickness, and in the very early stages, and sadly enough, Mrs. Carey's mental ill health. The mental disorder and distress which harrowed Mrs. Carey and her home for the next 13 years dates from this misery. The misery, of course, being that they lost one of their children almost as soon as they landed. And because he had no money, the money wasn't getting through from England. And what's more, letters didn't get through for 2 years to him. It was too much for her to bear. The new climate, the sea voyage, and she loses her mind. Ill with dysentery, her firstborn son was worse. Unable to afford even bread, appalled at their destitution in the strange and friendless city, her brain began to give way. Her kindly nature suffered change. Who shall lay
her melancholy to her charge. Nothing was here for reviling, everything for compassion and tears. And Carey lived with that, bearing his wife, bearing her estrangement, bearing her reproaches, all through those next 13 years, whilst he's bearing many other things and accomplishing many other things at the same time. Shortly they moved on to Kalutala. I may not pronounce these words correctly, but I don't suppose anybody here is going to attempt to correct me. And he commences a business in the indigo trade, which I understand is producing a kind of dye. And this is a business he goes into, and he and then his future colleagues continue in business all their lives through. They believe that the whole mission and the missionaries should be self-supporting, and they never received the money which came from England for their own support, and all the money they made in their business endeavours was ploughed into the mission on the field there. And that was the way they lived. They only kept back sufficient for their everyday need. And so they set up in this indigo business. They had a lot of problems with that, with labour and so on. And then eventually they had to move again. The place was very dank and wet, and they were not well, and they had to move again. But they believed that they were there under the will of God, and they began to work hard. They had another son who died. He was 5 years old, and that was Peter. And at this, the wife becomes totally deranged, so that altogether she is unable to face any of the problems that Carey was facing. This is indeed, he writes, the valley of the shadow of death to me, except that my soul is much more insensible than Bunyan's Pilgrim. Oh, what would I give for a sympathetic friend to whom I might open my heart? But God is here, who not only has compassion, but can save to the uttermost. I drown my heaviness of heart by writing to England. Oh, that this day could be consigned to oblivion. Mine is a lonesome life. That's how he was feeling. You can feel the sense and the strength of this situation that he found himself in. Also, of course, he was distressed with the idols and the ignorance that was all around him. Their ignorance is extreme, except with a very few learned men. They know nothing of geography or astronomy, but are much addicted to astrology, casting and nativities and observing lucky and unlucky days, which fill them with fancied troubles. Oh, my friend, he's writing to a man named Blundell. Oh, my friend, were you with us, you would see every corner full of idols, and at every mile end the high places. Such are their sacrifices that they would continually excite your compassion and abhorrence. You would feel an increase of affections, and would labour with a new ardency to establish the kingdom of Christ. He began, of course, as he was learning the language, he began preaching along with Thomas, and people were showing a great deal of interest, and they became very courteous toward them, but they had no converts. He was studying the language, and he had one convert in the early days, but it wasn't an Indian convert, it was a Portuguese Roman Catholic, and this man was converted through reading one of the pages of the New Testament they'd been writing out. Carey, to explain what it was like for him, and his increasing band of people round about him, tells us in this way: what would you think now if you were obliged to go from home, and we bade you let off the water from the vat? I'm sorry, again. This is the passage I meant. This is the way in which he describes what it would be like for us to go out there. He says, "Do not send men of compassion here, for you will break their hearts. Do send men full of compassion, for many perish with cold, many for lack of bread, and millions for lack of knowledge." He likens it to going into England without knowing the language, and without there being transport, and having to start right from the beginning. And that was the kind of situation he found himself in. His main thrust, of course, was in translation and printing, and he decided that he was going to get hold of the language Sanskrit. This was only known by the higher classes of people, but in the knowledge of Sanskrit was the key to all India and to all other languages. And so he got into that and began to learn it. He would be one of the first of the Europeans to do so. And by 1797, he had a Bengali New Testament translated and ready for the press. By 1800, almost the whole of the Bible was ready for the press, and they were beginning to experience a number of more conversions, but still amongst the Europeans. And now the whole mission was about to make a move to Serampore. This is 7 years after their first arrival in India. And so in January 1800, they moved to Serampore. The Moravians had been preaching here and had preached here for 15 years and had left without one convert. And of course the Moravians, if anybody could get converts, the Moravians could get converts. But they preached here in Serampore 15 years and had no converts. So they moved to Serampore, they set up the buildings, and they aimed to continue at their language and their translation and preaching. And of course again they were up against idolatry and corruption. They rejoiced greatly over their first contact. It was a man who came to listen to them, and this man came to know the Lord Jesus Christ. Now they don't give his name, but what they do say is this, that after he made a great confession and was about to identify himself with them as a Christian, he completely disappeared. They were dashed again to the ground. They believe that the man would probably have been murdered, but it dashed them again. There was great rejoicing over him, but that was soon turned into mourning. You know, God's ways are past finding out, aren't they? You know, these men, they really were put through it, and then, as it were, to be tantalized almost with that first convert. And then came along Krishna Pal, and that was the first hymn we sang tonight. That was his hymn. And Krishna Pal was a convert, their second convert, and he was baptized. Shortly after his baptism, his daughter disappeared, and he never saw her again. She must have been taken. She went down to the river one day. She was going down to wash, and that was the end. And Krishna Pal, in the early years, was not very stable. He would make great profession and then he would lapse back again. And I think that's why we get in that hymn of his this idea, O thou my soul, forget no more the friend who all thy misery bore. And it wasn't until a little while on that he actually became the solid and helpful man that he later came to be, preaching and working in the gospel. Within weeks, others were converted. One or two women were converted, and then some more men. And this began to be the ingathering, which was to amount to thousands in due time. By 1801, 1 year later, the first Bengali New Testament was published with great thanksgiving. Copies were sent to the King of England and to the King of Denmark. The King of Denmark was later to encourage them very greatly with donations and with land, and he even wanted to honour them with state honours, but they refused that. They did receive the two gold medals which he sent them, but they refused the honours. But the King of Denmark apparently was a godly man and greatly encouraged them in their work. I want to concentrate by way of conclusion on two main areas of work which they did in Serampore. There was first of all the language and the printing, and then secondly and finally the institution. But before we get onto those even, I do have to tell you of what was his sideline. When he was in Leicester, his sideline was science. When he was in India and in Serampore, his sideline was his boyhood interest, botany. And he was always absorbed with the matter of botany. Carey founded the Agri-Horticultural Society for India. He lamented the lack of, in even cultured Indians, of interest in this subject. He said, "They never conceive of the possible experimental improvings of cereals, herbs, vegetables, fruits, spices, dyes, drugs, and timber, to say nothing of the science's pure intellectual and aesthetic satisfaction." And he was really disturbed that none of the Indians, even the cultured Indians, had no interest in horticulture or agriculture. He sent everywhere, all over the world, for seeds and tubers and plants. He gave careful instructions how they were to be gathered, how they were to be packed, how they were to be hung in the ships, how they were to be watered. He sent back to his home, he treasured daisies. Every time a bag or a box arrived with something in, he would shake the bag out so that he'd get every little seed that might have got stuck in the sacking. He grew things from seed. He had lovely little daisies growing out hunting the jungles to get stuff for him from Africa. And all this was being poured into Serampore. And he writes on one occasion to his son, who's now a missionary in another part, "Every possible vegetable production," he wrote to Jabez. This is Jabez, is the one who was born whilst he was down at the ship and his wife was still back at home. Every possible vegetable production, including live birds, small quadrupeds, monkeys, etc., beetles, lizards, frogs, serpents, may be put into a small keg of rum. Add greatly to my stock. You must persevere. And at his death, his son Jonathan describes this amazing establishment which he had there. Let me just find this for you. In Serampore. "No one was allowed to interfere in the arrangements of this, his favourite retreat. And it was here he enjoyed his most pleasant moments of secret meditation and devotion. His arrangements were in the systems, and to disturb a bed or border was to touch the apple of his eye. It formed the best and rarest botanical collection of plants in the East, to whose extension, by his correspondence with eminent persons in Europe and other parts of the world, his attention was constantly directed. In return, he supplied his correspondence with rare collections from the East." He was recognized by Oxford and by the botanical institutions of this country as having one of the greatest products there. And I understand that there are still areas of that in existence today. We must turn now to the language and the scripture translation. I'm coming on towards an end, so you haven't got too much longer to listen. Here, the output was phenomenal. The literary work was accompanied by a breakthrough with true converts. Literally, after one after another came in quick succession. Carey writes in this way about it: "What hath God wrought? 18 months ago, we should have been in raptures to have seen one Hindu eat with us. Now it is sometimes difficult to find room for all who come. 9 Hindus have been baptized, of whom 7 walk so as to be an honor to the gospel. We expect to baptize a Muslim man and another Hindu before Captain Haig leaves us." And, of course, this figure soon ran into the hundreds. Language, he mastered Sanskrit, Bengali, Masathi, Punjabi, Telugu, Kannarasat, and later on Chinese. He produced 6 grammars, 3 dictionaries, 2 Indian classics, 10 volumes of Ramayana, which is a kind of Eastern Iliad, and besides many other writings. And Carey's diary for one day give us some idea as to how he did all this, because he was at work when everybody else had gone to bed, and he was at work when everybody else got up. This is how the day started on June the 12th, 1806. 5:45 to 10 o'clock. Hebrew, prayer, Bengali, family worship, Persian, Hindustani, breakfast, Ramayan, Sanskrit. 10 to 1:30, college. 1:30 to 6 o'clock, dinner, Bengali, Isaiah proofs, Sanskrit, Matthew proofs, with Mutajare. 6 till 7, tea, with Telugu and a visitor from England. 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock, prepared and preached English sermon to about 40. Got £60 from a judge, present for our Calcutta chapel. 9 till 11, Bengali, work on Ezekiel, later to a letter to Ryland, Greek chapter, a Greek chapter. And so he finishes his day off. Well, I mean, I just wouldn't get through the first hour of all that. I really wouldn't get through the first hour. But that's how he packed everything in and got all these things done. And converts were coming as a result of the literature. There's an account, a lovely account, how that on one occasion a man finds one of these New Testaments in his own language, and he sits down and he reads this New Testament, and he reads it again, and then he's converted. And so he gets his friends round him and starts to tell them what's in the New Testament, and his friends are converted as well. And so there's quite a little awakening takes place in one of the villages through this New Testament, which has come fresh off the presses. At this time he loses his wife, and that of course is a great gift to him. He later on remarries, and who does he remarry? Well, a woman who's an invalid. And but the bond and the love that is between them is something to read in these books. The love that he has for this invalid wife, he had to carry her out. I mean, as if he needed a helpmate, really. But she was a helpmate in her praying, in her intelligence, in her understanding, and her encouragements to him. And three of his four sons by his first marriage, of course, also became missionaries, but there's no time to tell of them. And then on the 12th of March 1812, there is a fire. He happens to be away at the time, but there is this awful fire. Nobody knows how it began, but it was almost total. And Marshman, one of his colleagues, wrote to him about the fire. And I do have to read to you the way in which this is described. We would fain have all the window shutters but one were bolted from within. We would fain have torn them open to save things, but an expert forbade us, and indeed shut the open one to stifle the flames. We organized carriers, and Ward mounted and pierced the roof over the area of trouble, and for 4 hours we poured in water to the great abatement of the fire. But injudicious friends, counting it safe at last, forced a shutter, and I saw flame leap to the centre of the building. In half an hour all was ablaze, and salvage was the only thing possible. Though precious little of that. We could rescue the 5 presses, for they were in the room adjoining, which as yet had not caught fire. They were only transferred there 2 or 3 weeks since. Had they been still in the main room, they could not have survived. When we broke the windows of Ward's office and pulled out the almirah and his desk, but except our title deeds and the translation fund ledgers, they held nothing of account. And so we see how that there was this great devastation. And Carey is writing like this. I began this letter last night. I closed it hastily this morning, having received intelligence of a dreadful loss which befell the mission last night. Our printing office was totally destroyed by fire, and all its property, amounting to at least 60,000 rupees or 70,000. Nothing was saved but the presses. This is a very heavy blow, as it will stop our printing the scriptures for a long time. 12 months' hard labour will not reinstate us, not to mention loss of property, manuscripts, etc., which we shall scarcely ever surmount. I wish to be still and know that the Lord is God, and to bow to his will in everything. He will no doubt bring good out of this evil, and make it promote his interest. But at present, the providence is exceeding dark. No lives were lost. We cannot tell what was the cause of fire. And so the scene was indeed desolate. Ward, one of the workers on moving the debris, actually did find 14 fountains of type, which was unharmed, but everything was devastated. They got the largest amount of paper in stock they'd ever had. They'd only just bought that, and the whole thing was wiped out. They were reprinting within 52 days. He refused to submit to Eastern passivity, and he indulged wholly in what he called Western drive. And they began next morning assessing and clearing. And by the end of July, as I say, only 52 days later, they were printing again in several languages. This was a testimony to their faith and ability. Before long, they were producing 22 versions of Scripture. Now that is, to me, one of the great miracles. And then we've got to end with the institution. Are you thinking of retiring? I've been talking with a man today who's got a couple of years to go. He's thinking of retiring at 60. He's got a couple of years to go. That's how old Carey was. He was just over 57. And at the age of 57, he starts the biggest work of his life. The biggest project. It was described in these words: a most Catholic college of Eastern and Biblical and Western learning. It was to be based upon Reformation principle. Carey writes about it thus: we are ready to think that our labours may operate on the people more slowly than once we expected. When they first went there, of course, they expected they were going to get converts and establish churches and so on, but they realised that wasn't happening. So it was going to be slower than they expected. But in the end, it would be more effectual, as knowledge, once fermenting, will leaven the whole lump. This may not be so encouraging, and may require more faith and patience. But it appears to have been the process of things in the Reformation, during the reigns of Henry, Edward, Elizabeth, James, and Charles. Should the work of evangelizing India prove thus slow and silently progressive, still the grand result will be our recompense. We are certain to take the fortress. If we can but persuade ourselves to sit down long enough before it, we shall reap if we faint not. That, he felt, was a principle of the Reformation. These were the people, and he goes on to argue it out, about Whitfield and Tyndale and so on. These were the great scholars, and these were the people who worked at educating the masses. And that's what he was going to do. By now he had 600 baptisms, they got thousands of adherents, and they got schools for 8,000 children in their care. But that wasn't enough. India, he believed, must be reached by her own sons and daughters. And daughters weren't thought about in England at that time. But he was going to think about not only the sons of India, but the daughters of India. And he was going to teach them. And it didn't matter about their class or religion. These people were going to be taught whatever he could teach them. The doors were to be opened to everybody for a higher education and for all the classes. The principles upon which it was to be based were to be that none should be denied entrance. Teaching would be in Sanskrit first. Everybody would have to learn that. Formerly, Sanskrit had only been the sacred knowledge of the upper classes. He would teach Sanskrit to everybody, and he would teach all in all the Indian languages. English would only be taught as an added incentive to those who wanted to take it on. They would teach science and art of both the East and the West. They would teach the religions and cultures of India and of the East, as well as biblical Christianity. And of course, many people in this country wouldn't have accepted that. That's why he didn't ask their permission. He just got on with it. They ploughed their money into it. They bought the ground. They paid for the buildings. They paid for the tutors. What was his purpose? Well, his purpose was this. It was a whole-orbed education for the people. And he was going to compare. You see, he could see what their religions produced. and he was going to show them what Christianity could produce, and he was going to put it before them, and he was going to teach them. And this is literally what he did. He taught their religions. He opened the whole thing up. And although he was a particular Baptist and a strict Baptist at heart, this is what he said. This is not to be Baptist, but to be free as the air. It was to be the most Catholic college. It was to be as free as the air. He believed that the different divisions and denominations that were in the home country should never be mentioned in India. He says there'll be time in 100 years' time to start talking about denominations. Now, he says, we've got to reach the masses. I mean, people today are still going out and trying to export their denomination. This man was way ahead, even of our own century, in many ways. He was 60 when he was doing all this. And by the time it opened, he had got 200 students of all ranks. Even the building itself was built so as to elevate the mind. The man was a great believer in the elevation of man's mind, even by things beautiful. We've lost this, you know, as evangelicals. I believe this is a most important. He looked at whole men. He looked at them in the dregs, and they were in the dregs because of what they knew and what they saw and what they didn't know and so on. And he realized that if he opened up and if he taught them and educated them, even showing them gardens and trees and shrubs and plants and flowers, it would elevate them. And this is what was said, the principal of the college: beauty is an educative force, and that the mere presence of grandeur elevates the growing intellect. That an institution housed anywhere dies, whereas enshrined in an adequate building, it will live through generations. He designed two huge staircases from the Grand Hall, and they had to be cast in brass in Birmingham. And he sends off to Birmingham for them. And they're so delayed in getting to India that they can't use the upstairs rooms for quite a long time till he gets these massive and grand, there's a picture of it, it's a most palatial and grand building. But he believed that it was to elevate the mind, lift them up out of the mud, you see. Show them something wonderful. How wonderful, how edifying. I've just had a young fellow of my church, he rushed in just as I was coming out tonight, and I said, well, I've only got a couple of minutes to spare with you. He said, look, I want you to help me sort out my records. And there he got all the modern stuff, you say. I said, well, stick it in the bin. And he did so. Thank God. And I quoted him one verse of scripture. I said, whatsoever things are pure and whatsoever things are lovely, think on these things. He says, that's what I think. And he's just got rid of them. He was converted about last October. So he got rid of all his trash. And that's what Carey believed. Think on high things. Think on beautiful things. Think on lovely things. And he was going to elevate the minds. He was going to capture India. And he had a mighty influence in all walks of life. Finally, they began to produce a monthly periodical, and then a weekly newspaper, and then one in English. And the whole purpose of it was that they could begin to champion the needs of the masses of the people. It was through these publications that sati, that was the practice of burning the widows with the cremation of the dead husband's body, and they would bind the widow on the pier, on the pyre, and when they set it alight, of course she would burn, and she was alive still. William Carey championed that and for the removal of that, and it is largely through his efforts that that came to an end. They had another awful way with them. If a person was found to have leprosy, they either burnt them alive or buried them alive. That's what they did with them. And the family, I mean, there's an account in the book here where the family digs a hole, they light the fire in it, the man himself rolls into the fire, when he feels the fire, he tries to get out again, and they just push him in with their feet. And the poor man perishes in the flames because he got leprosy. On other occasions, they just dig a hole and push them in and buried them alive. He fought it. He saw all this going on, and he was so overwhelmed with the awfulness of it that he had to fight it. Don't forget that this man was preaching the gospel all the way through. This man's chief concern was the salvation of their souls. He wanted people to come to Christ, but he saw people in their deep need as well in this life. And he fought for them in this life. Let me just read the account of a man who was a head at one time of one of the villages. And this was by a Reverend Potter, who tells the story of visiting a leper asylum on one occasion. At Agra, I was accustomed to visit the leper asylum with Pundit Harai Ram, a Brahmin convert. And of course the Brahmins wouldn't have walked on the same ground that the other scum of the earth walked on at one time. They were the princes, they were the men of the Sanskrit, they were the men who were the royalty of India. And he went with this converted Brahmin. One day I saw this good man, this Brahmin, with tears in his eyes as he spoke to the lepers thus: "Brothers, you owe much to the Lord Jesus. Here you are housed and fed, clothed and cared for by those who are his followers. How different was your condition under Brahmin rule. At my village of Basana, whose priest I was, a leper was once brought to me, and the villagers asked me what they should do with him. I replied, 'Dig his grave and bury him.' Under my instructions the grave was dug, and the leper forced into it, where he was buried alive." Well, Kari couldn't tolerate it, and he fought it, and he won. Thank God he won. And that had to be discontinued. Well, my time has gone. He died in 1834, aged 73, and that is 151 years ago this year. And I read this about William Carey from the pen of William Arthur, author of Tongue of Fire, a great Methodist preacher of last century. And this is what he says: "When Carey went out to India to seek its conversion to Christ, many a man of the world felt that he might just as well walk up to the Himalayas and order them to be removed and cast into the sea. Carey did walk up to the mountain, lonely and weak, and though it seemed far above all power to be shaken, he did say, 'Be thou removed, removed.' And the world looked on and laughed. But he went on saying it, and one joined him and another, and the voice grew stronger, and it was repeated in many languages. And now it is a considerable company that is uttering the word, 'Be thou removed and cast into the sea.' But you have not yet got it into the sea." "No, but it has been removed. It has stirred. No one can say it is where it once was." When Carey first went up to it. And that's it, friends. No one can say it is where it once was when Carey first went up to it. He stood before the mountain and he said, "Be thou removed." And you know, friends, we've got a lot of mountains in this country today. And when I finished this, I said, if Carey can say that for India, I can say that for Hinckley. And if Carey could say that for Hinckley, you can say that for Coventry. It's a far smaller mountain than ever India, than India. And my friends, I ask you this question: if Carey could move India, cannot we move Coventry? Cannot we move Rugby? Cannot we move Hinckley? Cannot we move our towns? Surely is the same God. And he went out for the whole man. He went out to educate him. He went out to raise him. But primarily, he went out to save him. May God give us the same vision. When men know that you care for them as men, then they are ready to listen to your gospel. May God teach us a few lessons tonight through these things. Amen.